So my name is Alfred Spohrmann. I'm a faculty dean at Stanford and teaching microbial physiology and metabolism. And Boris charged me to talk about metabolism, the fundamental aspects of how microbes use energy. And that's why I'm here. And first of all, I actually want to know who's in the course. Who are the students here? All right, awesome. Why are you here? What do you want to learn? Evolution. And you guys?
How microbial communities work.
Okay, evolution and how microbial communities work. That's the sort of the framework which ties essentially metabolism together. The point of this lecture today is to help sharpen your view to think about metabolism in order to understand fundamental aspects of microbial life. And I want to talk about microbes because they are simple. They are among the most abundant biomass on Earth, and you can actually do experiments with those. And as I understand, you isolate them actually from different environments. So it's useful to think what's actually going on in terms of selection when you isolate these organisms, and what are the fundamental features in terms of metabolism that the organisms have, and how this explains the diversity of organisms that you're looking at. Okay. Okay, so when talking about how microbes use energy, there are two good guidelines. The first guideline was formulated by Ludwig Boltzmann, and for those of you who are physicists know this pretty well, it says the fundamental object of contention in the life struggle in the evolution of the organic world is available energy. And in other words, if you want to understand life, you follow the energy, because the energy is essentially driving these processes. The second equally important phrase was coined by Albert Szent-Györgyi, who discovered vitamin C, is that life is nothing but an electron looking for a place to rest. And you can see how Szent-Györgyi actually expanded the concept of energy and focused the view of energy on an electron. It's all about electrons. And the driver for electrons to find a place to rest is thermodynamics. And that's what I want to talk about. So, oh, by the way, if you have any questions, so interrupt me. What's so funny about it?
That's all everyone does here.
Okay.
Now it's too late.
It's too late. So, this is the simple scenario of a microbial cell. This is the artist's drawing of a microbial cell. It's basically an energy transformer. There's environmental energy in different forms, chemical or physical energy, that is assimilated through what is called catabolism. So all those biochemical reactions that are involved in conservation of available free energy. This energy is used to synthesize ATP. And the consumption of ATP is either for maintenance, if the organisms don't grow, for example, if because some of the nutrients are lacking, or it is used for biosynthesis in order to make new cell mass. So in order to understand the evolution and the physiological outfit of organisms, we need to understand what are the rules that sort of control anabolism, and what are the rules and diversity that controls catabolism. So first looking at anabolism, well, this is also associated obviously with energy and the flow of energy. I first want to focus on anabolism, so those biochemical reactions that are involved in synthesis of new cell material. I'm not considering repair and maintenance. So the energy content of one ATP, and I should say, I'm assuming you heard about thermodynamics, change in free energy, and this currency of ATP requires under standard state, under cellular conditions, about 50 kilojoules per mole to synthesize. In other words, If ATP is utilized in processes, you hydrolyze and release energy of 50 kilojoules per mole. Where does this energy go? Well, on a big picture, only 5 kilojoules out of this 50 kilojoules are really used to do chemical work. 45 kilojoules, or 90%, is released as heat. That may sound painful, because here's the cell going through all the contortions to conserve energy, and then only 10% is used. So we need to talk about that. So why is that? So if you're if you're looking at anabolic pathways across the kingdom in terms of bacteria, animals, and plants, there is sort of a paucity of biosynthetic pathways, meaning the pathways for alanine biosynthesis, for arginine biosynthesis, for nucleotide biosynthesis, for cytochrome biosynthesis, are pretty conserved. There are some variations there, especially in plants, but no overwhelming diversity, which we do find actually in catabolic reactions. Consequently, the way that this transformer work, how this ATP is used to produce cell mass for bacteria, is fairly constant. There's a useful empirical formula. We can, per mole of ATP, you can synthesize about 10 grams of cells. This varies a little bit if you have autotrophic organisms. So autotrophic organisms that fix CO2 and don't have any precursors or reduced carbon material in their medium, that yield is around 5 grams per cell. If you have intracellular pathogens like rickettsia or chlamydia, that's a bit higher. Because, why?
The host cell does the work?
Yes, the host cell, who was it? Okay, great, yes. The host cell did the work because these precursors, the monomers, were already synthesized by the host. But this is a useful number. Now, where does the cell, the energy go? For anabolism, there is the synthesis of monomers, amino acids, fatty acids, nucleic acids, and then there are polymerization reactions. That's basically what you can think of in terms of anabolism. If you think of just the synthesis of monomers, for example, if you look at the synthesis of acetate or pyruvate, for those of you who are a little bit familiar with that, acetate, pyruvate are key substrates for amino acid biosynthesis and so on and so forth. The synthesis of this from CO2 is exergonic. In other words, this does not require energy. So for the synthesis of monomers, there is not much cellular energy required. The big cost comes in polymerization. So if you look, for example, in translation, you're forming a peptide bond. That's basically what keeps proteins together, amino acids together, to make peptides and proteins. And each peptide bond has an energy of hydrolysis of about minus 16 kilojoules per mole. So to make one peptide bond, you need 16 kilojoules. If you add up how many GTPs are consumed during translation, you come up with a number of about 6. And that's pretty much the same in eukaryotes or prokaryotes. And since each ATP carries 50 kilojoules, the cell spends 300 kilojoules to make one 16 kilojoule peptide bond. And since most of the cell mass is protein, this is basically where the energy sink is in the cell. Now, the big question is, why in the hell are the cells doing this? Because if they would be more efficient, they could produce 5 times more cells, right? Because you spend the energy to produce, you make more peptide bonds. Any thoughts of why the cells get away with this inefficiency?
Maybe that's not the limiting factor.
Maybe that's not the limiting factor. Why would this then still allow for the inefficiency? So I agree with you, there could be other factors limiting for cell mass. But would you then say that the stoichiometry would be variable? It'd be recycled. What is it?
The energy that you're putting into that bond, can you get that energy back later?
Excellent question. So we are talking about 16 kilojoules. So the cell needs to harvest about 16 kilojoules. The synthesis of ATP under cellular conditions is 50 kilojoules. And even if you have a proton gradient, that's 20 kilojoules. So it's a great idea, it's just not enough. Yes?
It's not clear that the predominant force for selection is going to be efficiency, that there could be selection for growing more quickly rather than having the most efficient reactions.
Okay, yeah, so we'll get at the rate in a minute, but what is the consequence, so if you wear your physicist hat, of producing heat which cannot be mechanistically recovered in a bacterial system for ATP synthesis? What does it mean from a physics or even chemistry point of view for this entire process? It's a thermodynamic drive. It makes the process irreversible, physiologically irreversible.
How do you get 6 instead of 4? Because it's 2 to make the amino acyl tRNA, and then it's 1 GTP for peptide bond synthesis, and it's 1 for elongation. So many biochemists use 4 instead of 6.
Yes, but some produce AMP. That's the equivalent of 2.
Yeah, but I said 2 to make amino acyl tRNA. That's 2 ATPs. One for translocation, one for peptide bond synthesis is 4.
And then there are a couple of GTPs. We can go through these numbers. That's the numbers are right. But you're right that it basically gives this process a directionality. It gives a directionality because it's physiologically irreversible, and therefore the organisms produce biomass which does not chemically just reverse into the precursors. And that's ecological success. So apparently the cells use this inefficiency to basically drive a production of biomass into viable offsprings. Any other thoughts?
So is heat necessarily a bad thing? I mean, at least for larger organisms, they want the heat, right?
Great. So that's exactly what it is. Is heat necessary a bad thing? Larger organisms control the heat for reasons just to have a constant biochemistry. A bacteria don't control the heat. But this heat is a lot. If you actually look in industrial fermenters for the fermentation of ethanol or amino acids, if you have a 10,000 liter fermenter, you have to cool this fermenter because of this heat. Biologically speaking, heat is really important because it drives processes. In this case, we elaborated, it drives anabolism, but there are also catabolic processes, there are regulatory processes which gives directionality. So in as much as Gibbs free energy is extremely useful and essential for biology to function, heat, and the engineers don't like to hear it, but the inefficiency is also very important. Yes?
So it's for accuracy, no? You need a big energetic drop to be able to get your, stream to write the right order of amino acids together. You cannot do that for free. That's going to cost you a lot of irreversible energy.
Well, you could think of a process which has highly selective, highly specific enzymes, and then you just need, 16 kilojoules to make a peptide bond.
Then you need a lot of these specific enzymes if they're going to be specific.
Sure, you need at least 20.
No, I mean, the other day becomes reversible, no? I mean.
Right, that's the whole point. It becomes reversible if you don't produce heat.
Well, why do you need that much heat?
That's a good question. I wasn't there when evolution started, but the. If you take the line of thought that each hydrolysis of ATP to produce heat gives each step a directionality. You basically push the steps in terms of peptide synthesis forward. We have actually the same thing in terms of if you take, for example, the fate of acetyl-CoA, when cells, acetyl-CoA is a key intermediate in biological processes. And acetyl-CoA, well, where can acetyl-CoA be used?
In the TCA cycle?
In the TCA cycle, yes. Where else?
Fatty acid synthesis.
Yes, fatty acid synthesis. How do you distinguish which acetyl-CoA, you as a cell, so I'm becoming anthropomorphic, you as a cell, how do you distinguish the acetyl-CoA that goes into either fatty acid biosynthesis or into the citric acid cycle?
Depending on the concentration of the products for each reaction?
Yeah, so the enzymes then in the cell would compete for a common pool. That's a tough one for a cell physiologically and biochemically to manage if you have competing pathways in the pool. Because if you go into the citric acid cycle for an organism like E. coli or the pseudomonads that you are isolating, that ATP basically goes more or less into energy production. The acetyl-CoA goes into energy production. For fatty acid biosynthesis, you are basically earmarking this acetyl-CoA for growth because you're producing lipids. So these are two different different parts, anabolism versus catabolism, and the cells need to distinguish between that.
So the cell, these molecules are the same, right? Sorry, this is a dumb question, but I mean, I always thought that all the acetyl-CoA and all the Krebs cycles, like phospholipids or whatever, and all the, it's the same molecule.
Yes, okay. It is. No isotope signatures, nothing.
MPK decides.
Pardon?
MPK decides.
MPK.
AMPK.
AMPK, meaning?
Adenine monophosphate, kinase, whatever.
Oh, that's eukaryotic.
Okay.
so if you remember the entry step into fatty acid biosynthesis, you need acetyl-CoA moieties. But what's the first molecule? It's malonyl-CoA, which occurs by an energy-dependent carboxylation of acetyl-CoA to make malonyl-CoA. And malonyl-CoA then initiates the polymerization of acetyl-CoAs. But you can make fatty acids just with acetyl-CoA. That's what the fermenting bacteria do. If you do Clostridia, or if you go to bioenergy field, if you take butanol or butyrate, this condensation to form a longer chain fatty acid just occurs with acetyl-CoA. So, on one hand, biochemically, you can do polymerizations with acetyl-CoA. On the other hand, there are mechanisms that choose to go via malonyl-CoA, where, in a sense, the energy, the ATP that is required to carboxylate malonyl-CoA is released as heat. So with this line of logic, this is better to understand, because if you take the acetyl-CoA pool, and that acetyl-CoA that is earmarked for biosynthesis of fatty acid is carboxylated under consumption of ATP. And this ATP is then hydrolyzed. So this ATP, this acetyl-CoA does not flow back into the general acetyl-CoA pool. So the use of producing heat is a general phenomenon to give directionalities to metabolic pathways. Okay, any other thoughts? So how do we think about pathways? Now, in order to get sort of some signatures of pathway, and I took a little bit out of that. You're taking a simple, so I'm now looking at a catabolic pathway. So those pathways that cells use to extract energy from the environment. And that's where we have a really high level of diversity. And the question is, what are common denominators, principles of the design of these pathways? And what pathways would you expect in the organisms that you are isolating, or what pathways would you expect in the organisms where you have a genome sequence, metagenomes, and you want to try to infer metabolism. For a catabolic reaction, the delta G of this reaction has to be negative. That's obvious. So energy is released. You have typically pathways in a series of steps, and in this generic pathway, there are different sites where ATP is generated. And as you know, there are typically substrate level phosphorylation or electron transport phosphorylation or transport coupled phosphorylation, where mechanistically ATP can be conserved. Now you can describe this overall equation in terms of the flux of free energy to those so each reaction obviously has a delta G value, and since energy is additive, the overall change in free energy is the sum of the individual reactions. So you might have some endergonic reactions and some exergonic reactions. That's fine as long as the overall delta G is negative. We know we need about 50 kilojoules of ATP, of energy to synthesize an ATP. So along the lines, as we discussed earlier, if you have a peptide bond, if you want, for example, an organism to grow, to try to recover the energy from a peptide bond, that's only 16 kilojoules. That would be a reaction like that, because mechanistically you cannot conserve this. But yet, these energies are released. So in terms of the overall allocation of the energy, simply based on the pathways, there's a number of reactions which lead to the synthesis of ATP. So that's the delta G of ATP synthesis times N, and the N would be here 3. And there is a term, delta G net, which is unused. That's sort of irreversibly lost. As I said, I already said this, for the synthesis of ATP under standard state conditions, one molar concentration of substrate products, we need plus 32 kilojoules. Under cellular conditions, with 10 millimolar ATP, 1 millimolar ADP, 1 millimolar phosphate, we require, this should be a plus 50 kilojoules for the synthesis. And if you consider that typically, pathways is not just a single reaction, but a sequence of reactions where you have also energy that cannot be recovered. This basically amounts to about 60% efficiency. So for a good pathway like glycolysis or any other pathway, you need about 80 kilojoules practically as an input to form one ATP. So going back to this general level of how to think about catabolism, so those biochemical pathways involved in energy formation, you need at least minus 50 kilojoules per mole. And if you look at the different biochemical pathways, metabolic pathways that they are around, the amount of heat produced varies quite a bit. There are some organisms which looks like no heat is produced in the catabolic part. There are other organisms, which we'll talk more about, where the cell actually controls how much heat is produced. There's an ecological reason for that. Now, I want sort of to pose another problem, and I want you to think about it. What if there's an organism that conserves a certain amount of ATP from overall reaction and doesn't produce heat? What is the consequence of the irreversibility of that pathway and for the energy consuming pathway in general? Let me rephrase. Let's say in the example that I just gave you, 60% is released as heat and 50 kilojoules are conserved to form an ATP. That's what E. coli does, that's what your Pseudomonas does. What is the effect, ecological effect, of the organism to recruit the environmentally available resource in a general sense? Could be chemicals or other things. Why not go for 100%? Yeah, well, in the concentration, that you don't see this in the overall equation. If you measure the environment, the concentration of environmental resources, you don't see the concentration effect. And transport, dependence on the organism, is not that costly. Then why would it be advantageous for an organism to not be 100% efficient in this catabolic pathway, in the sense 100% efficient to use all available energy?
It's very naive, because otherwise you can revert the reaction and release the...
Yes. Is that also what you wanted to say? Yeah. It basically gives a directionality in recruiting these resources into this organism. There's a huge ecological benefit for that. Now, I said there are some organisms which operate at the thermodynamic equilibrium, where this is almost close to zero. How do you think, with respect to what we discussed the sort of the last half an hour, organisms actually are dealing and finding a solution for that presumable reversibility of the catabolic pathway?
I mean, if the anabolism is irreversible, then it's fine, because it's just the ATP, and then you consume it for anabolic pathways. Because then you're in equilibrium, so then you have more modified and more ATP.
Right.
But that's in the case where you have a lot of resources.
Yes.
And it would suggest that they have they'd be more efficient but in getting the energy out, because they're losing less of it, but they would have less ability to use super low concentrations.
That's an interesting thought. So the organisms that I'm talking about are typically deep sea sediment organisms, where you have really low fluxes. Concentration, I'm not sure how concentration would solve the problem. There was somebody else said something.
Are they like at lower temperature or something, so they need less of an energy?
Oh, yeah. Well, the chemical reaction is temperature dependent, but that's all for all temperatures. But in the end, the enzymes are adapted for a certain temperature. So you don't buy yourself something out of this bottleneck.
You have a coupling reaction that decreases the amount of substrate that goes into the first reaction?
Yes, yes. And what could that be?
Another anabolic pathway?
Yes, anabolic pathway, and that's what you also said. The anabolic pathways are so irreversible that even in a relatively reversible catabolism, ATP hydrolysis is driven in this direction and not going back. Cool. All right. Now let's talk a little bit more about these catabolic reactions. This is the first simple view, again, to think about microbial metabolism. So any interaction with the environment has a metabolic basis. There's catabolism, which is essentially there to provide energy, and a substrate is converted into a product. And blue for the rest are all these anabolic reactions that I talked about. The main point here is to provide energy and also some intermediates, especially if you have a carbon pathway. The resources, the environmental resource, is a compound that is used in a catabolism and anabolic substrates to make the carbon, the cell, the reduced nitrogen, and the reduced sulfur. the compounds in the environment obviously don't know what their fate is. So this is really conceptual. But I want you to think about, for all the organisms that you isolate, and also for those that you assign a genome and interpret the genome, to think in catabolism and anabolism, because that gives you some structure in terms of thinking about metabolism. So St. Georgi is back, because obviously it's tied to of an electron trying to find a place to rest. The other way to rephrase this is that life is redox chemistry. And this redox chemistry plays out typically in the catabolic pathway. So rather than having one line, we're looking at redox chemistry coupled half reaction, for those of you who know chemistry, where we have one oxidative pathway. So, and I'm indicating here the electrons here with the hydrogen. And this hydrogen, that's a, it's called a reducing equivalent. And it's basically defined as an electron plus a proton. For most reactions, cells don't deal with single electrons. Typically, they're coupled with protons to reduce reactivity. And there are NAD, NADPs, there are flavins, and so on and so forth. So there are different electron carriers. And if I don't care what the electron carrier is, so I'm a little bit on a higher level to think about how pathways are organized, I'm just talking about a reducing equivalent. What I really mean is we are pushing electrons. Okay? So the reducing in this oxidative pathway, some substrate is oxidized, produces reducing equivalent, and both in this part, as well as in the reductive pathway, so where you have a co-substrate, which is then reduced, energy is conserved. When you eat your breakfast, you ate glucose and you were respiring oxygen. Glucose was oxidized to CO2, and oxygen was reduced to water. Every catabolic reaction has that basis. And it's useful to think about this, because this gives you a guidance of where electrons flow and where the energy comes from. So, as I said, in both parts, mechanistically different though, ATP can be conserved. And this ATP then is used in anabolic reactions. But in addition to the ATP, other important metabolic intermediates are also transferred. One is reducing equivalence, because for biosynthesis, some compounds are more reduced than others. You probably heard that you can assume that the average oxidation state of carbon in the cell is around zero, but fatty acids are much more reduced. That's why they're good biofuels, and others are more oxidized. So if an organism like E. coli grows on glucose, where the carbon has an oxidation state of zero, and the cells need to synthesize fatty acids, these electrons, to reduce that carbon even further, must come from somewhere. And that's basically another important link to catabolism. So for anabolic purposes, these reducing equivalents are also taken out of catabolism. And if you have an organotrophic organism, again, E. coli or Pseudomonas, other intermediates like pyruvate, phosphoenolpyruvate, or acetyl-CoA, or some TCA cycle intermediates are also taken out of that. So the link between catabolism and anabolism is not just energy. Energy is a big thing, but it's not just energy. I will show you now variations of these principles. Life is redox chemistry, and for growth, certain requirements need to be met and couple catabolism to anabolism. And these, before I get there. This is to think in oxidation and reduction reactions is extremely useful, because you can predict the microbial metabolism. The basis for that is, again, that this overall reaction, how the electrons flow from a donor ultimately to a reduced acceptor, is basically the delta G of the catabolic reaction. since we're dealing with half reactions, so here we have a chemical half reaction as an oxidation, here we have a reduction, you can look at this in a slightly different way. Now, to read this chart, I plotted here the redox potentials of half reactions. And these reactions on either side are the same. There's only a difference in terms of whether this reaction occurs in the oxidative direction or in the reductive direction. So how do you read this? The Nernst equation says that the difference in the redox potential between the donor, this is sort of considered if you look at a compound that's an electron donor, and here if the oxidized form is an electron acceptor, that this energy, the Gibbs free energy that is available for energy conservation, is the difference in the redox potential between both of those. So that means here we have formaldehyde or glucose at a redox potential of minus 470 millivolts. And here we have oxygen as electron acceptor. That error goes down by a big part. In other words, a lot of energy is released, specifically 2,900 kilojoules per mole. So you couple it with the organism E. coli or Pseudomonas couples the half reaction of oxidation of glucose to CO2 with the reduction of oxygen to water. Since this is modular, we now have an enormous degree of freedom to combine different half reactions into new overall catabolic pathways. And that's really what nature does and where the diversity in occupying different niches and accessing resources comes from. So, for example, here we have hydrogen oxidation to proton. You can, if you're thinking of sort of how hydrogen can be oxidized, we have all these compounds available. Hydrogen is a sweet compound. You can oxidize hydrogen with oxygen, but you can also oxidize with nitrate, with fumarate, with hydrogen sulfide, and even with CO2 to make methane. It's basically when you have this line here, and you have methanogens, hydrogen utilizing methanogens. Or you can use sulfate reducers when you go out here in the tidal pool that oxidize hydrogen with sulfate, or with iron, or with nitrate. So when organisms have simple half reactions for nitrate reduction, for sulfate reduction, they can, if the thermodynamics is right, couple this with almost, well, it's certainly not infinite, but with a large number of oxidative reactions. You can also predict that, for example, if you care about ammonia in the environment, fertilizers. Here's ammonia oxidizing to nitrate, or nitrate. If you look at this chart, you can predict that you cannot oxidize ammonia with iron, because this goes uphill. You will never be able to isolate an organism that can do that. The only way to oxidize ammonia would be with manganese. Then you reduce manganese 4 to manganese 2, which changes environment, and now you have a niche for an organism that oxidizes manganese 2 with oxygen, if there's manganese in your system. So thinking in terms of redox chemistry, oxidation and reduction reaction, gives you a very useful framework, first of all, to predict thermodynamics and to predict pathways and how they are coupled. So what kind of enrichment, Paul, are they doing enrichment experiments? Are you isolating bugs?
Lizzie, are you not doing any enrichment?
Not here, no, but I'd like to.
Okay. Then maybe in the interest of time, we can talk about this later. Actually, if you guys are must do some research and work with some favorite organism, it's useful just to think about when you have a medium and you have a natural ecosystem, to think, what are my chemical, what are the resources in the environment? Are they oxidized and reduced? And how do they relate to each other thermodynamically? Because that allows you to make predictions. It also allows you to make predictions if, for example, let's take sugar and we have oxygen in our medium, so fresh water. Then you primarily will get, as an enrichment, you will get organisms that couple this reaction efficiently and fast. If you do this experiment with seawater, and seawater has 28 millimolar sulfate, well, what happens? So, okay, here's another thing of physical chemistry. What's the solubility of oxygen in water?
Part in a thousand?
Yeah, so at room temperature, it's about 250 micromolar when it's saturated. So if you have organisms that consume oxygen and you don't aerate it well, it becomes oxygen limited, right? And 250 micromolar doesn't get you very far if you get 24 reducing equivalents out of one glucose oxidation, right? So in other words, if you don't introduce oxygen in your seawater, this becomes anoxic fairly rapidly. But now you have 28 millimolar sulfate in the system, which then opens up a niche for sulfate reducers to use this resource. And they're not competitive in the beginning because there's oxygen, but oxygen is rapidly consumed. And sulfate is reduced to hydrogen sulfate because this niche is available. What is the consequence of this activity for this environment, for your enrichment bottle?
Sulfidic.
It gets sulfidic. So you change the environment, right? You change the environment and now you produce hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide now moves onto this side because it is a reduced form and can serve as electron donor. That means if there's now an interface of hydrogen sulfide with anything that is more positive in terms of redox potential, that's a new niche. So if you do your enrichment bottle, just seawater and let it stand there and put in a bucket of sugar, there's no succinate, no iron, no nitrate, and so on and so forth. But at the interface, on top, there's oxygen. So in other words, now you have a niche where hydrogen sulfide can be oxidized with oxygen because it goes through a sulfur loop. As a consequence of this activity, that comes as a consequence of the activity of a sulfate reducer, which comes of the consequence of the activity of an aerobe depriving the system of oxygen, you start to have basically a loop of sulfur that is a big driver to maintain a diversity, a metabolic and genomic diversity in your system, because depending on if you have a structured or unstructured environment, that basically keeps sulfur cycling locally within organisms in close vicinity. That's a metabolic interaction. That's an interaction of that microbes have. Yes?
Okay, will it be done with different species? Can it be done with human
species? So in the same species, for example, E. coli uses oxygen, or let's say Pseudomonas, it's harmless here, use nitrate. Usually when oxygen is consumed, they switch to nitrate respiration. And depending on how you set up the bottle, if there's an interface with oxygen, small amounts of oxygen, that population will respire aerobically, whereas the rest in the dissolved liquid phase will be respiring an anaerobic electron acceptor. Was that your question?
But in seawater, you said nitrogen levels low, right?
Yeah, that's about lower micromolar. Yeah, yeah. So a C1 in the planktonic phase in seawater, a nitrogen cycle doesn't play a significant role. This plays, what I just explained, is really common in sediments. And I'll give you an example of, actually, why don't we do this now? Actually, I'll get, yes, Boris.
Yeah, maybe just rephrasing Terry's question. So are there constraints on you know, what electron acceptor a given cell can use at a given time?
Great, great question. So in other words, wouldn't it be cool if a cell has all of these pathways? You're ready for any shit that can happen, right? Because any changes in the environment, the organism would be ready for that. That's not what we find. We do find, however, that there are some organisms, like Pseudomonads, that have a large variety of different oxidative pathways, hydrogen utilization, certainly different pathways for using different organic compounds, aromatic compounds, and so lignans, and so on and so forth, and a few electron acceptors. On the other hand, they are totally niche specialized organisms, like methanogens. Methanogens, there are two classes, acidoclastic and hydrogenotrophic. These methanogens only go on the oxidation of hydrogen and CO2. The $10,000 question is, why is that? Why do we have this strong speciation in one case of organisms, but not in the other case? And I have an answer, and I want to run this by you. And I need 10 more minutes to that. Is that okay? So, take home message. Life is redox chemistry, and it's very useful to really have a quantitative understanding of the connection of reduced and oxidized environmental compounds, because you can predict which organisms you can find in this environment and which not. Yes?
Are there any drawbacks of making it too big of a jump? Or
No.
You're releasing too much energy in a single step to some extent?
No, that's...
You contain?
No. I mean, we have these organisms here, and they are doing perfectly fine. It all depends on the niche in the environment that you find this organism. Okay. So let me show you some variations of this theme, this general theme, that is useful to think about organisms if you're going to major groups of organisms that you're studying in the course. So here we have uncoupled oxidative and reductive reactions. In fermentation, these are coupled in the sense that the cells take an amino acid fermenting organism or a glucose carbohydrate fermenting organism. These oxidative reactions produce as an intermediate a compound that serves as an electron acceptor, because fermenting organisms have the problem that there's no external electron acceptor present. That's typically the environment that they live in your gut, when you make yogurt, and so on. Somebody's making cheese here, right? Right? When you make cheese, there's no oxygen. So the only way to deal with organic compounds is to ferment it. And then you get propionate and Swiss cheese and all these other decarboxylated amino acids. So the fundamental principle of fermenters as a variation of this general theme here is to produce a compound that serves ultimately as an electron acceptor, because life is inherently redox chemistry and ATP is coupled to this shuttling or transfer of reducing equivalents. Make sense? Okay. How about lithotrophic organisms? So lithotrophic organisms are those that use inorganic compounds in the environment. Totally important, for example, if you're looking at organisms that can oxidize ammonia with oxygen. They oxidize ammonia to nitrite and then oxygen to water. Now, the problem that these organisms have and solved in the following way is that these organisms don't have a carbon compound in their catabolism. In the literature, and even in colloquial sort of discussions on microbiology, people always say, or often say, oh, this is a Pseudomonas that uses glucose as the carbon source. you're missing an important point there. Yes, glucose is a carbon source, but it's also an electron source, and that's fundamentally different because the carbon source goes into this pathway, and the energy source goes into this pathway. And the biochemistry and the rates of these pathways are different. Now, since this organism does not grow on a carbon compound, it needs to fix CO2 into formaldehyde to mark oxidation state of formaldehyde to produce biomass. If there would be organic matter in the environment, these organisms would not have much of a need. In sewage treatment plants, you have this, and you find this organism, but they are autotrophic. So for autotrophy, the oxidation state of this carbon is at the oxidation level of +4, compared to 0 of the cell mass. So in other words, there need to be net reduction reactions. And as I said earlier, these electrons for these reductions come ultimately out of this oxidative pathway. So in other words, a much higher flux of electrons towards biosynthesis has to come from this catabolic pathway, which reduces the electron flux into this pathway. That's a penalty. Furthermore, these electrons coming from the oxidation of ammonia here at a redox potential that is way too positive than for the NADH for biosynthetic reactions. And since all the biosynthesis goes with NADH, the organisms need to spend a lot of energy from this, not just for polymerization reactions, but simply to activate these electrons and to produce biomass. So that's a constraint, an inherent constraint that comes with lithotrophic organisms. And phototrophic organisms, well, they have no net electron transport in energy conservation. It's a cyclic process. So there is no moving around of reducing equivalence in a net way. So these electrons for CO2 reduction need to come from somewhere else, and that's why cyanobacteria take water and oxidize water to oxygen, and purple bacteria oxidize hydrogen sulfide to sulfur or sulfate, and so on and so forth. But it has environmental consequences, not only on the energetics, but now you're basically producing other oxidized compounds. And that essentially is the way how oxygen arrived on this planet, because photosynthesis, the invention of oxygenic photosynthesis, provided oxygen as a new niche for the adaption and the evolution of other organisms. So, let me see. Let me skip. To. So much good stuff. So to this theme that we developed, so here we have an organism. There's a physical chemical environment with resources. There are some invariant resources that are not used, but some variant. There's the physical chemical environment, whether it's structured, unstructured, whether it's fluctuating or non-fluctuating. It has huge implications for what kind of metabolic features are being selected for. And then you have this biological interaction. As a result of the catabolism, substrates are consumed and products are formed. The products can be the reduced compounds. Products of photosynthetic organisms can be the oxidized species like oxygen or sulfur or iron, iron-3. That is produced out of the need to fix CO2. But this then becomes a new available resources, depending on whether or not you have other oxidized or reduced other compounds in the environment, provides a new niche for organisms to adapt. And here's one great environment. Anybody seen this before? What is it?
Microbial mats.
Totally awesome environment. The real size of that is maybe a centimeter or less than a centimeter, depending on where you are in the environment. And this is a really a good way to understand the interaction between microorganisms and the environment and between microorganisms themselves. So the microbial mats, this is the top layer of a sandy sediment. You have cyanobacteria here, you have then here a layer of purple bacteria. There's a faint green layer here, which is a different photosynthesis than the oxygenic photosynthesis, and there's a black layer of sulfate reducers. These mats predictably exist over eons. If there's a winter storm and just puts new sand on top, in other words, it mixes all organisms, by the summer, this new layer has stratified in exactly that. So what is the metabolic interaction in this microbial mat? So let me see. Here are the organisms. This is a green layer. I guess the color didn't came out that way. The green layer for the cyanobacteria. Here's the purple layer. Here's the other green layer, and here's the black layer. What drives this ecosystem? So what do you have in there? What's in the aqueous phase in of a sediment, seawater sediment?
Sulfate.
Yeah, sulfate. How much?
28 millimolar.
Yeah, it's pretty. That's serious stuff. 28 millimolar. What else? Come on. There's water, yes. And what's on the surface, since you can see it? What?
Light.
It's not trivial, it's light. Huge. And light is actually the driver that keeps this entire diversity alive. So how does this work? Light is used, the blue arrow indicates anabolically, to oxidize water and to produce the electrons for reducing bicarbonate to biomass. So stoichiometric to the biomass form, to the ecological success of cyanobacteria, oxygen is produced in this environment. In fact, if you can grow them in the lab, and then if there's on a full day, you see all bubbles, basically air bubbles, in the top layer that comes from the oxygen. So what is the environmental consequence of this activity? Well, there is biomass is formed and oxygen. Then you have these so-called heterotrophs, the bandits. They basically take biomass, lyse cells that lyse from phages. Phages have no interest in producing substrate for heterotrophs, but as a consequence of phage biology, cell material is lysed. And this organic matter can then, together with the oxygen that is produced by cyanobacteria, being used by heterotrophs, aerobic heterotrophs, that basically produce a bicarbonate. So that explains this niche of these organisms. Now, oxygen can also diffuse in the deeper zone. Now, for the deeper zone, we have to now to think of the following, that at this level, there is no oxygen available. And light is not used by cyanobacteria, but by purple bacteria. Purple bacteria are doing also a type of photosynthesis. The fundamental difference is the source of electrons for CO2 fixation. Cyanobacteria get it from water. Purple bacteria from hydrogen sulfide. And they have this great purple color. So while light, being diminished in intensity in these sediments, penetrates to the purple layer, these purple bacteria use hydrogen sulfide. Rest for a minute where the hydrogen sulfide comes from. And use bicarbonate and have their anabolic reaction to produce more purple bacteria, so have an ecological success. As a consequence of that, sulfate is produced, sulfate and biomass. So you see the congruency here in these two reactions, and that's It's good that you see this. So sulfate then can be then used as an electron acceptor because there's no oxygen available in this depth, and therefore selects for sulfate-reducing bacteria exclusively to oxidize organic matter that ultimately comes from the phototrophic organisms. Sulfate reducers then have their niche to oxidize organic matter with sulfate, producing hydrogen sulfide. If the seawater is rich in iron, sulfide precipitates with iron to form iron sulfide, which is a black precipitate. So that's why this is a black layer. And this end product of this sulfate-reducing bacteria then becomes again the substrate for the purple sulfur bacteria, where again this loop of metabolic interaction, or this relationship of metabolic interaction, is only determined basically by light. So you can actually close this off and maintain the system in a closed bottle and just feed it light. Another consequence of the hydrogen sulfide is, for example, what happens in the dark? This is a great show for 12 hours per day. And then night hits. What's the consequence then in the night?
Elevated concentrations of sulfide.
Elevated concentration of sulfide because this sink of sulfide oxidation is absent,
right?
Which means that hydrogen sulfide now can actually diffuse through this layer and can come into contact with oxygen that comes from the atmosphere, because the cyanobacteria also shut down. In fact, they consume oxygen because they're using storage compounds for respiration and storage compounds that they store during the day. So in the night, then you have this interface between hydrogen sulfide and oxygen from the top, which creates a new niche for these colorless sulfur bacteria that oxidize hydrogen sulfide with oxygen. You get an idea of how the dynamics of this ecosystem is and really what the relationship between these organisms is, which is all metabolic. Yes?
What causes it to be an ecosystem and not a single bacteria that does multiple of those?
Pardon?
Why is it an ecosystem and not one bacteria that will take on two or three of those functions?
That's a great... So I guess I'm giving another lecture on Friday, so I'll give you the... explanation for that, but the bottom line is competition leads to speciation. So, and it's essentially a rate-yield trade-off that plays out in this ecosystem, because it's such a predictable environment. In a predictable environment where you have competition, and you can tattoo this in the underarm, if you're in a predictable environment under competition, this drives speciation. So if you take, there's a great experiment that Julian Adams did in E. coli, grew E. coli on a glucose-limited chemostat for 800 generations, and E. coli speciated into two organisms, two subspecies, all derived from the ancestral strain, and the ancestral strain is gone. That means in a steady environment, there's a drive for speciation if there's competition. And there's a lot of competition here. But I'll talk about this again.
Paul. So a related question then is, if I sample microbial mats around the world, how much ecological redundancy should I see at each level assigned?
Redundancy in terms of what?
Different species performing the same role.
Oh, you might have different species, but the roles are the same.
I agree. But at each of these levels, would you expect the same amount of species biodiversity?
Great question.
And I don't think you would.
What do you think? I think this is a great question. What do you guys think? So there are great microbial mats on the East Coast. You go to Woods Hole and we go to Alcorn Slough here. And all around the world you find these microbial mats. Would you expect differences? Why would you expect differences? And if so, on what would these differences depend?
I think one thing that would influence it would be the type of organic matter that's getting put into the system. So is it only from autotrophic production from the cyanobacteria? Do you have other inputs from, you know, Spartina or other things that are sort of dumping organic carbon into that system? You could have a much more complex pool for the heterotrophs.
Right. So environmental resources, so that the seawater is not exactly the same. As you said, there's some other resources which I didn't talk about because it actually distracts from the main thought, that actually depend, that control the outcome to an extent. In other words, if there's sort of competing organic matter also in this ecosystem. What else? So in a larger sense, the concentration of environmental resources. Why is it that you don't find these mats? That's a good question. Maybe that's one to close. Why is it that you don't find these mats really in freshwater sediments? You know it.
Did you hear what she said?
What?
There is enough oxygen in freshwater?
There is enough oxygen. Why would there be enough oxygen? What?
Like there is recycling of oxygen because the water flows everything.
Ah, so you're saying there's a different mixing of oxygen into the system. That could happen, but that's not what I was hoping for. Think of an environmental resource. Think about an environment. What's the fundamental difference between salt water and a fresh water?
Salt.
Salt. What salt?
Anything that's
char.
Liquid.
What?
Char.
NaCl. Great point. Let's think about this for a minute. NaCl. What can we, in terms of microbial metabolism, what niche does this provide? Niche in terms of resource for catabolism or anabolism. We need to have a beer. So it's an overall flux through the cell. So think redox. Sodium is oxidized. Chloride is reduced. Conceptually, only chloride could be an electron donor, and sodium be an electron acceptor. So you make elemental sodium. That's not very compatible with biology. And to oxidize chloride to chlorine gas. Right? So it's pretty inert. So yes, salt, but it's not sodium chloride that is microbiologically relevant. Thanks for bringing this up. No, I'm serious. What? Magnesium, all right. How do you think about that? And what is the counter ion? Well, we just went through the disappointment of chloride.
Sulfate?
Sulfate. All right. What about magnesium? What could be a role of magnesium?
It was on your table-y thing, and it was about halfway down.
It what?
The thing like 5 slides ago, it was about halfway down.
Yeah, yeah. So,
about it.
Is this an electron donor or an electron acceptor, microbially?
Donor.
Well, I don't want to flip through this. So it could be an electron donor, but there's not much microbiology really out there. There are manganese oxidizers, but there has been a long debate on whether manganese oxidation confers any benefit, simply because the organisms were also maintained on high organic matter, so you just need to know.
Alfred, we have to wrap up. And
right, so the lunch is here. Lunch is sulfate. Because sulfate, That's the salt in the seawater that is different, that's absent in fresh water, and therefore this doesn't allow for this sulfur cycle. So you don't have colorless sulfur bacteria, you don't have purple bacteria, and you don't have sulfate mucuses, because there is simply no sulfate, although the sulfate would be cycling, but with 28 millimolar, you're cycling much more than with 0.2 millimolar, which you haven't seen. Okay, so I guess our lunch is ready, or?
Well, lunch is not provided. You have 15 minutes to grab some lunch, if you want to eat lunch during the talk, and then at 12:15 in the main seminar room for this.
How long is that talk?
It's an hour.